Okay, so now I will start from the knot between two of the concepts proposed to the reflection of our panel, equality and emancipation. Well, I will briefly recall two main points that are implied for me in the idea of emancipation. The first one is that equality is not a goal to be reached. It is not a common level, an equivalent amount of riches or identity of living conditions that must be reached as a consequence of historical evolution and strategic action. Instead, it is a point of departure. This first principle immediately ties up with the second one. Equality is not a common measure between individuals, it's a capacity through which individuals act as the holders of a common power belonging to anyone. This capacity itself is not a given whose possession can be checked. It must be presupposed as a principle of action, but is only verified by action itself. The verification doesn't consist in the fact that my action produces equality as a result. It enacts equality as a process. I act, we act, as if all human beings had the same intellectual capacity. Emancipation first means the endorsement of the presupposition I'm able, we are able to think and act without masters. But we are able to the extent that we think that all other human beings are endowed with the same capacity. Second, emancipation means a process through which we verify this presupposition. Equality is not given, it's processual, and it's not quantitative, it's qualitative. So this idea of emancipation dismisses the contrast made by the so-called liberal tradition between freedom, thought of as the inner autonomous power of the individual, and equality, thought of as a constraint of the collective over individuals. Free is just like equal. It doesn't designate the property of individuals. It designates the form of their action and of their relation to other individuals. The presupposition of equal capacity is a principle of shared freedom, opposed to the presupposition that the human beings can only act rationally and cooperate rationally according to a principle of subordination. Autonomy has been a key concept in modern emancipatory politics, but autonomy doesn't mean the autonomous power of a subject as opposed to external forces. It means a form of thinking, practice, and organization free from the presupposition of inequality, from the hierarchical constraint and the hierarchical belief. It means the opposition of two forms of common sense or two forms of common words, one based on the verification of inequality and the other based on the verification of equality. This is what is entailed in the concept of disagreement that I proposed to conceptualize the political conflict. Disagreement is not a conflict of forces, nor even a conflict of ideas and values. It's a conflict between two common words or two common senses. This is what is meant by the scenario of secession of the Roman plebeians on the Aventine, but I put at the center of my analysis of disagreement. In the common sense which grounds the domination of the patricians, there can be no discussion between the patricians and the plebeians because the plebeians do not speak, they just make noise. The presupposition of inequality is not a simple idea. It is embodied in the concrete reality of a sensory world, so that the plebeians must not simply argue that they are speaking beings too, but also invent a whole dramaturgy to create the sensory world where the unthinkable and even imperceptible fact that they speak is made perceptible. Emancipation makes us think of politics in terms of conflict of words rather than conflict of forces. But it's a conflict of common words. Social emancipation is not simply the choice of community against individualism. A form of community is always a form of individuality at the same time. So the point is not about the presence or absence of social links, it's about their nature. Capitalism is not the reign of individuality. It organizes a common world of its own, a common world based on inequality and constantly reproducing it. So that it appears as the world, the real, unique, existing world in which we live, move, feel, think, and act. In front of its sensible evidence, The world of equality appears as an always tentative world that must be perpetually redrawn, reconfigured by the multiplicity of singular inventions of acts, relations, and networks, which are their proper forms of temporality and their proper modes of efficiency. That's why the cessation of the plebeians on the Aventine is paradigmatic. The world of equality is a world in the making, a world born of specific breaches in the dominant common sense, of interruptions of the normal way of the world. It implies the occupation of specific spaces, the invention of specific moments when the very landscape of the perceptible, the thinkable, and the doable is radically reframed. The conflict of words is dissymmetrical in its principle. But the fact is that this dissymmetry has long been obscured by the evidence of a middle term that seemed to be common to the world of equality and the world of inequality, and also to designate at the same time a world and a force. That term was work, with its twin named labor. Work was the name of the force that capitalism gathered and organized for its own benefit, and it was a reality of the condition of those who were exploited by capitalism. But on the other hand, it was a force that would be reassembled against the capitalist power, both as a force of struggle and the form of life of the future. In such a way, it appeared to be both the product of inequality and the producer of equality. The two processes were made one single process, and the Marxist tradition set up this conjunction within the progressive scenario according to which inequality is a means, a historical stage to go through in order to produce equality. Capitalism was said to produce not only the material conditions of a world of equal sharing of the common riches, but also the class that would overthrow it and organize the common world to come. And to play this role, the workers' organization had to take up and internalize, first in the present of struggle, next in the future of collective production, the virtue that had been instilled into them by capitalism, the virtue of factory discipline, Lenin said. Well, the anarchist tradition opposed to that view of inequality producing equality, an overview emphasizing the constitution of three collectives of workers, anticipated the community to come through both egalitarian forms of organization and the constitution in the presence of forms of cooperative work and other forms of life. But this counterposition still rested on the idea of the middle term, the idea of work as being at once a form of life, a collective force of struggle, and the matrix of a world to come. It is clear that work can no more be posited today as identity of a force and a world, of a form of struggle in the present and a form of life in the future. Much has been said about the end of work or it becoming immaterial, but capitalism did not become immaterial, even if part of its production is knowledge, communication, information, and so on. Material production did not disappear from the common world that it organizes. Instead, it was relocated far from its ancient locations in old Europe, in new places where the workforce was cheaper and more used to obeying. And immaterial production also implies both classic forms of extraction of plus value from underpaid workers and forms of unpaid labor provided by the consumers themselves. Work did not disappear. Instead, it was fragmented, torn out, and dispersed in several places and several forms of existence, separated from one another so as to constitute no more a common world. Along with economic disruption came the legislative reforms adopted all over the world to make work again a private affair. Those reforms did not simply remove the rights and the social benefits acquired by the workers' struggles of the past. They tended to turn work, wages, job contracts, and pensions into mere individual affairs concerning workers taken one by one and no more a collective. So work has not disappeared, but it has been stripped of the power that made it the materially existing principle of a new world embodied in a given community. This means that we are now obliged to think of the process of emancipation, the process of equality creating its own world as a specific process, disconnected from the transformations of the global economic process. But we are also facing the difficulty of dealing with this situation. I think that this new situation and the difficulty to deal with it are perfectly expressed by the slogans that have resonated in several languages during the recent movements: Democracia Real, IA, Nuit Debout, Occupy Everything, or Namin, Sizumi, Zanturi. All of them take on their efficiency in an ambiguous interface between the logic of the conflict of forces and the logic of opposition of words. Occupy and occupation are the most telling examples of this ambiguity. They come from the historical tradition of working class struggle, the sitting strikes of the past, when workers occupied the workplace, made a conflict of force identical with a demonstration of equality. While blocking the mechanism of exploitation, the strikers also affirmed a collective possession of the workplace, and they turned the place dedicated to work and obedience into a place for free social life. The new occupation takes up the principle of transforming the function of a space, but this space is no more an inside space, a space defined within the distribution of economic and social activities. It is no more a space of concrete fight between capital and labor, as capital has increasingly become a force of dislocation, which destroys the places where the conflict was staged. The occupying process now takes place in vacant spaces, those buildings that the contingency of the real estate market have left empty, or the streets, normally destined to the circulation of the individuals and the commodities, and sometimes the demonstration of the protesters. The occupying process transforms both places destined to the circulation of persons, commodities, and value into places where people stay and affirm, by the very fact of staying, their opposition to the capitalist powers of circulation and dislocation. So the name occupation is still the same, but the occupying process is no more a conflict of force to take over a strategic place in the process of economic and social reproduction. It has become a conflict of words, a form of symbolic cessation that is both materialized and symbolized in a place aside. Occupy Wall Street took place in a park situated beside the center of his financial power that has destroyed the factory that previously was the site of occupations. The Spanish movement of the Indignados created, during an electoral campaign, assemblies that presenting themselves as the seat of real democracy now. Real democracy was pitted against the self-reproduction of the representative caste. But real democracy also had been, in the Marxist tradition, the future of material equality opposed to bourgeois formal democracy. It was a future promised as a consequence of the takeover of the state power and the organization of collective production. Now, it designates a form of relation between human beings that must be practiced in the present, both against and besides the hierarchical system of representation. Real democracy, in a sense, has become more formal than the formal democracy once stigmatized by the Marxist tradition. Not only did it equate the enactment of inequality, of equality with the form, the enactment of equality with the form of the assembly where all individuals have an equal right, but it imposed a number of rules such as the equality of time allowed to all speakers and the power for individuals to block the decision of the majority. So occupation has become the name of a secession, but that secession is no more the action of a specific community claiming their rights. Instead, it appears often to be the materialization of an aspiration to the common, as if the common were something lost, something that had to be reconstructed through the specific act of the assembling of a multitude of anonymous individuals publicly performing their being equal as the same as their being in common. That's why that cessation, that being aside, had been expressed in paradoxical terms, and notably by the strange slogan, very strange for the people of my generation, adopted by many assemblies as the affirmation of real democracy, consensus instead of leaders. It seems paradoxical to posit consensus as a specific virtue of the decentral assembly gathered in occupied spaces. It can be objected, of course, that the dissensus precisely consists in the constitution of another form of community based on horizontality and participation. But the problem of democracy is not so much perhaps about the number of people that can agree on the same point, as it is about the capacity to invent new forms of collective enactment, of the capacity of anybody. Well, by underlining this paradox, I'm not willing to disparage those movements. Some people I know have contrasted the pacifism of the consensual assemblies to the necessity of violent action directly confronting the enemy. But the confrontation with the enemy itself can be thought of and practiced in different ways. And most of the forms of direct action opposed to the pacific assemblies, for instance, destructions of bank automats, shop windows, or public offices, had the same character as them. I mean, they were also symbolic expressions of an opposition of words rather than strategic action in a struggle for power. Other people have precisely criticized this lack of strategy. They say that those movements could change nothing to capitalist domination, and they made new calls for the edification of avant-garde organizations aimed at taking over the power. Such an answer, I think, is unable to solve the paradoxes of emancipation. The strategic worldview that sustains it is a view, is still a view of inequality producing equality. That strategy has been enacted by the communist parties and the socialist states of the 20th century, and we all know the results. Inequality only produces inequality, and it does it ceaselessly. Moreover, the strategic worldview has lost the basis on which it rested, namely the reality of work, labor as a common word. So we are now facing again the dissymmetry between the process of equality and the process of inequality. Equality doesn't make words in the same way as inequality. It works, as it were, in the intervals of the dominant world, in superimposition to the normal meaning, the dominant hierarchical way of world making. And one of the main aspects of this dissymmetry is precisely the fact that the process of equality questions the very separation of the ends and the means on which the strategy of inequality producing equality was predicated. This is what freedom means ultimately. Freedom is not a matter of choice made by individuals. It is a way of doing. A free action or a free relation is an action or a relation that finds its achievement in itself, in the verification of the capacity and no more than external outcome. In the hierarchical societies of the past, it was the privilege of a small category of human beings called the active men, in contrast to all those who were subjected to the reign of necessity. In modern times, freedom was democratized, first in the aesthetic domain with the Kantian and Schillerian category of free play as an end in itself and a potentiality belonging to everyone. Then the young Marx did more, as he made it the very definition of communism. Communism, he said in the Paris manuscripts, means the humanization of the human senses. It is a state of things in which this capacity of humanization is deployed in itself, instead of being used as a simple means for earning one's living. And he illustrated it with the case of these communist workers he met in Paris, who gathered at the first level to discuss their common interests, but did it more deeply to enjoy their new social capacity as such. Okay, true enough, Marx's analysis still relied on the identification of work as an essential human capacity. When work can no more play this role, the task of creating a world where the ends of the action are no more distinct from their means may seem to become paradoxical in itself. The free and equal community is something that can no more rely on a given empirical substratum. It must be created as an object of will. But on the other hand, this will can no more be posited in the terms, the classical terms of the means and ends relation. That's why it tends to become a global design for another form of human relationships. This turn was best illustrated in the Occupy Wall Street movement by the multiple extensions of the use of the verb occupy. For instance, occupy language, occupy imagination, occupy love, and eventually occupy everything, which seems to mean change your way of dealing with everything and with all existing forms of social relationship. Perhaps this enigmatic slogan found the best translation in the great slogan, Namin si zungit lamizuri. What, to live no more like slaves, the sentence invited not only to rebel against the intensification of the capitalist rule, but to invent here and now modes of actions, modes of thinking and forms of life opposed to those that are perpetually produced and reproduced by the logic of inequality, the logic of capitalist and state domination. Thank you.